You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Toku Ingoa. No mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapari Thursday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Nicholas. E whai aki nei, coming up on the show, I speak to academic and Palestinian New Zealander Dr. Rand Hazu about New Zealand's response to what is happening to Palestinians in Gaza. Nicholas, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to lecturer of language and culture at Auckland University of Technology, Richard Pamatato, about the potential lack of Pacific Island representation in the National Party caucus. I also spoke to professor of ecology at Massey University, Dr. Diane Brunton, about the university's proposed cuts to the science campus at Albany.
He aha o whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces today, so get in touch. Tuku patuhi mai, text in on 5395. Or Wire by Rane, give us a call in the studio on 09309 3879. Ka oa e wariwari e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero āno hi pakihiri rohi rohi maoranga i te pai tuku tuku o Irirangi Poho. Mi haere ki 95BFM i te kati.com, and you can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Can anyone explain why the modern-day whales are so big?
The Wire.
As it currently stands, the National Party would only have one MP of Pacific Island heritage. Angie Nicholas is currently ahead by just 30 votes in Te Atatū, with special votes still to be counted. It is probable that these results may change. I spoke to lecturer of language and culture at the Auckland University of Technology, Richard Pamatato, about the potential lack of Pacific Island representation in the National Party caucus, as well as reasons why the National Party appeals to some members of the Pacific Island community. I started by asking Professor Pamatato about what he thinks of the current makeup of National's caucus.
For National to have no Pacific Island MPs means that they are missing out on a whole lot of insight into how those various populations behave, how they live, how they lead their lives. And if you don't have those people informing you at a conversational level, at a caucus level, then how do you know what you are proposing is going to work for those particular communities? And we've seen that before. If you want to know what's happening in a community or a population group, you need to have a representative of that person in the group at the top table saying this is what's going on. And if Angie Nicholas does get in, she's going to be able to be that voice.
Yeah, and along those lines too, the potential coalition partner, the ACT Party, wants to disestablish the Ministry for Pacific Island Peoples. What do you think of that being disestablished? Do you think that the Ministry for Pacific Island Peoples is necessary, and what detriment do you think that will have on the Pacific Island community if it is disestablished?
The Ministry for Pacific Peoples is not a ministry of delivery. It's a ministry that provides information. And not having that means that a government in which ACT is part of is just going to be missing out on data. And it follows, there is a view that one size fits all, but we know that one size does not fit all, and you need a ministry like the Ministry of Pacific Peoples to ensure that the needs, the hopes, the aspirations, etc. of the Pacific population is put into the conversation around how policy is formed, how people think about these groups, and actually there's an edge to what David Seymour saying that is actually very, very nasty, and he is signalling people, he's race-baiting by saying that. And, you know, we need to have that conversation about what actually is his real intention. And that is something that Mr. Luxon will need to manage as he puts together a coalition, because the Pacific population is growing. It is the most fertile group within the New Zealand population. And in 10, 15, 20 years' time, those people who have supported David Seymour and has moved to get rid of that ministry will have other issues that they have to deal with. I think it's a very short-sighted move by David Seymour to say that he would get rid of that ministry and the other ministries that he set his target.
Historically, the Pacific Island community has leaned towards voting for the Labour Party. What do you think the major drivers of that are?
So the Labour Party's always framed itself as a party for people who are working and who are working generally in more manual or labour-intensive jobs. And so that's where a lot of the South Auckland and West Auckland Pacific population is. Also, those pockets of Pacific people in the forestry towns, for example. And so there's been an appeal to those voters in Labour. And Labour has delivered in some ways for the Pacific population in ways that National hasn't. But what we are seeing also is a change in the voter makeup, because as more Pacific people become middle class or upwardly mobile, they're rethinking where their loyalties lie and what's going to be best for their back pocket. But until now, most of the significant changes have come from the Labour-led governments.
That was Lecturer of Culture and Language at the Auckland University of Technology, Richard Pamatato, speaking on the potential lack of Pacific Island representation in the new National Caucus.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
And we'll be right back after this quick song break. Keep it on the B.
save Auckland from the monster. It's using the Sky Tower as a javelin.
But my powers have been drained.
Then charge them.
The songs that usually juice up my powers aren't working. I need new music.
Flying Out will have new music for you. There might even be a new genre that will turbo boost your powers.
Flying Out, your local record store off Karangahape Road at 80 Pitt Street. Open from 10 a.m. every day, stocking all the good stuff. And always open online. Free shipping throughout Aotearoa.
Mass Appeal is here to resurrect your Sunday mornings with jazz, funk, hip-hop, house, and other slick selections from the sacred vault of High Priest Hudge. Mass Appeal, every Sunday morning from 10 to midday on 95BFM.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. Outgoing Prime Minister Chris Hipkins has shown support for a humanitarian pause in Gaza and establishing humanitarian corridors to protect civilians. But advocates say this response is not enough, with more than 60 community organisations and individuals signing an open letter to the caretaker Prime Minister, an incoming Prime Minister calling for New Zealand to take a strong stand, appealing for a ceasefire and for Palestinians in Gaza to come under United Nations protection. Approximately 2.3 million Palestinians have experienced severe shortages of water, food, electricity, medicine and essential healthcare services and persistent Israeli attacks for more than 2 weeks. The death toll for Palestinians in Gaza is now over 5,000, including 2,000 children. I spoke to academic and Palestinian New Zealander Dr. Rand Hazu about New Zealand's response to what is happening to Palestinians in Gaza. I started off our interview asking Dr. Hazu about his connection to Palestine.
I'm the son of a Palestinian journalist and a Kiwi nurse. I grew up in the Middle East, and I'm now lucky enough to call Aotearoa my home. My family is from Jerusalem. We're a Christian Palestinian family from Jerusalem. Our church is the Syriac Orthodox Church. We are a church that still holds our services in ancient Aramaic, which is the tongue that Jesus spoke in.
For those who might not be watching closely, can you give an update on the situation in Gaza and just how dire it has become?
Look, the situation in Gaza was atrocious even before the current hostilities erupted on the 7th of October and the subsequent Israeli bombing. People in Gaza have been living under a blockade. There's been numerous human rights and international observers who have condemned the ongoing blockade. Potable water has been at critical levels. Access to electricity, food, building supplies, medical supplies has been an ongoing issue for years, 15 years or so. I've got a close friend, her mum died because she had cancer and the Israeli authorities wouldn't give her permission to get out of Gaza to get the treatment that she needed. So when Israelis say that, well, they got out of Gaza, well, they didn't really. You know, they got out. It's almost like you get out of the house, but you lock all the doors. People haven't been able to pursue their rights and their freedoms. Students haven't been able to take up opportunities to offer scholarships abroad or fellowships abroad. Sports people haven't been able to give permission to leave Gaza to participate in competitions, etc. So this has been an ongoing horrible situation. The problem is now with electricity cut off as well. We can't actually get access to people on the ground. We can't get access to those voices, those human rights observers, those journalists, because there's effectively a blackout. And so Israel has created the situation where they're bombing civilian areas. And we know that there's hundreds of people who are suffering. There's about 5,000 people who have lost their lives now. Half of those are around children. So there's been 2,000 Palestinian children that have been killed by Israeli bombing. But unfortunately, we don't have access to those voices on the ground that can give us updates because there's no electricity, there's no phones. People can't record and upload a video. And this is an intentional policy by Israel. They want to create a blackout so that they can once again commit horrendous acts of violence and acts of war crimes with impunity so that no one can look over their shoulder and tell them to stop. So that's the situation at the moment.
We've seen yesterday that outgoing Prime Minister Chris Hipkins has joined calls for a humanitarian pause in Gaza. As a New Zealander with links to Palestine, what do you think of New Zealand's response to what is occurring so far?
Well, I think it's a pathetic response. I mean, why use the language pause? What does this mean? We want Israel to pause the bombing so that we can allow the little bit of aid that we've given to Gaza to get through so that we could feed some people so that they can be bombed again by Israeli bombs. I mean, this is ludicrous. I mean, let me just take a step back. I don't think people in New Zealand quite understand, you know, the aftermath of the mosque attacks, you know, and what happened. New Zealand very strongly, under the Labour government and Prime Minister at the time, stood up and said, no, the Muslim community matters. Your lives matter, you know, and if you're going to be the targets of senseless murder, we're going to stand with you. This is not acceptable. Now, that message reverberated all around the world. People looked at New Zealand, especially in the Middle East and the Muslim world, and they went, wow, okay, here's a country that actually, when they talk about human rights, they really mean it. They're not saying that rights only, you know, are deserved, people of European or Pakeha heritage are only deserving of rights. No, they mean it for the Jewish communities, but they also mean it for the Muslim communities. This garnered New Zealand such amazing respect, a cultural and political and social capital around the world. And unfortunately, when the current outgoing Prime Minister uses this kind of language of a pause, I mean, what they're risking is squandering this capital that, and this respect that we've built up around the world. We've got this heritage and this position in the world as a country that respects human rights, that advocates strongly for human rights. But when we hear the outgoing Prime Minister say things like, oh, well, we want restraint, when there's a military power like Israel bombarding and killing civilians and actually engaged in atrocity crimes, like they are advocating for ethnic cleansing. That's what they're doing. We cannot sit by silently and just say, oh, yes, a reasonable response is to ask people to pause the fighting. No, what they should be saying is we need an immediate ceasefire. We need an immediate ceasefire, unequivocal, and we need the return of all the hostages, not just the Israeli lives that were taken by Hamas hostages, but we need the release of 2.2 million hostages in Gaza that are sitting under this horrible, brutal Israeli blockade. I mean, these 70% of the people in Gaza are refugees. They've already ran away from conflict once. They've already ran away from conflict. They've ended up in Gaza. They've been waiting for years, to return to their homes, under international law, which is a right, a universal right to be able to, for refugees to return to. We are a signatory of the UN Convention on the Rights of Refugees, which means we recognize that people that run away from conflict should be able to return. And meanwhile, all this time, Israel has been stopping the refugees from returning. And not only that, they've been continuing to build illegal Israeli settlements. This is illegal under international law. So when New Zealand uses this kind of language, pause, we're asking for restraint. What they're basically doing is acquiescing. They're basically becoming complicit with Israeli war crimes. I mean, this is squandering the kind of political capital and the respect that we have on the international stage. You know, it's a very dangerous move. And we can't expect the same thing, you know, from the incoming Prime Minister, you know, who obviously has evangelical roots and has already come out and said, you know, without even questioning it, uncritically, we stand with Israel. I mean, who are you standing with? A genocidal regime? A country that is actually right now committing acts of war? That's who we're standing with? Why? Why did they come out so critically and not say, and maintain that position of respect and that commitment to human rights and to international law that New Zealand has always stood by? So it's preposterous. I mean, we do need, much stronger language from the New Zealand government. A ceasefire now. We need, observers and people like the Red Cross on the ground in Gaza now, exploring and documenting war crimes. And we need, the release of all hostages, not just the Israeli hostages, but also the 2.2 million hostages in Gaza that have been languishing under this horrible Israeli blockade.
And this morning we saw that an open letter was sent to both the outgoing and incoming prime ministers from community organisations and prominent individuals. Was this something that you were a part of?
Yes, so the PSNA, I think, and the PACC have written letters asking for a ceasefire, trying to highlight the situation on the grounds, meaning that once again Palestinian civilians are going to be wearing the brunt of this Israeli aggression. And again, we're just asking for the rule of law. We're just asking, you know, just because the terrorist organization Hamas commits acts of violence and commits atrocities does not give Israel to also commit acts of atrocities. This is the thing. Most people in this that are tied and connected to this conflict, that's all we're asking for, is the same rights, the same obligations to international law be applied. Not this double standard that we keep hearing from America, from Israel, that somehow Palestinian rights don't matter, that somehow Palestinian lives and children that are bombed by Israel, they get referred to as collateral damage. No, this is not right. These are acts of war. These are war crimes, and they should be regarded as such. So that's what the Palestinian community here in Altea is asking for. We're not asking for special privileges. We're just asking to be treated like every other human being, like to be protected, for civilians to be protected under international law. I mean, I don't understand why, you know, we saw this amazing contribution that, you know, that the world saw from New Zealand after the March mosque attack, and people are suddenly going, oh, great, you know, yeah, they're genuine about this. Human rights do matter. You know, if you're a Muslim, you have the same rights. You're cared for in exactly the same way. What we're seeing from the, unfortunately, from the international community, is a double standard, where they're saying, well, no, Israel as a colonial state, as an apartheid state, has the right to bomb the hell out of civilians, and they're going to get away with it. This isn't right.
We are also seeing this bias reflected in the media, and there have been several Palestinian solidarity marches taking place across the world and in Aotearoa even before 2 weeks ago, but there has not been a lot of media coverage on this event. So what would your message to the media be when it comes to reporting on this issue?
Look, we understand that the media here, because we know, we've talked to editors, we know that there's not this huge conspiracy that somehow, editors and people responsible content are sort of, you know, trying to intentionally invisibilize the suffering of Palestinians or the concern that the majority of New Zealanders feel for the Palestinian plight. But we do know that there are certain vocal groups, Zionist groups, that weaponize claims of anti-Semitism, and they're on the phone all the time when journalists are trying to do their job and trying to present, objective facts about the situation. We know that they receive harassment. We know that they're bullied. So what we would say to the media is, we don't want preferential treatment. We just want you to do your jobs. We just want you to do your jobs and to do them right and to uphold journalistic ethics. And if that means calling out Israel for war crimes, that means calling out Israel for war crimes. I mean, if that means looking at misinformation and disinformation that's constantly being propagated through the media by Zionist groups, that means calling it out. That's all we're asking for. And so, there's a kind of frustration, particularly among young Palestinians in Aotearoa, young Palestinian Kiwis, who have been asked for comment by the media. And when they try and bring nuance to it, when they describe, when they use words like, you know, Israel is an apartheid state, it's a colonial project, those key words seem to be absent from news reporting. And we're not sure why this is happening. And I suspect it's probably because the editors are just fearful that they're going to have those vociferous voices on the phone to them, calling them out and bullying them. And, we just think this is horrendous. Like, you know, we live in a free society, a democratic society, with a free press. This is integral to democracy. And journalists have to be allowed to do their jobs, have to be allowed to do them well. You know, people keep saying, oh, this is such a complex issue. It's not complex. It's colonialism. It's colonialism and occupation. And when we hear Israel and the Israeli Defense Force and the Israeli army warmongering and saying, oh, well, we need to go in and bomb, you know, Hamas and obliterate them. I mean, when has this idea of this military invention worked? When have we been able to bomb popular resistance into submission. It has never worked. It didn't work in Afghanistan. It hasn't worked in Iraq. So why are we allowing this idea to take hold as if there's some kind of merit to it? I mean, if we want to undo the situation that gives life and breath and support to Hamas, we have to deal with the occupation. This is the problem. But for years now, Palestinians in the West Bank and the people living in Gaza have been living, dealing with the consequences of occupation, and Israel has continued to thumb its nose at international law and continued to build illegal settlements. And this is the consequence. You know, the military, intervention is not the answer. The answer is trying to undo the occupation, and that is where we see, you know, a potential ending of the suffering and justice for all peoples, justice and peace and security for all peoples. But it's not going to come through this endless bombing.
That was academic and Palestinian New Zealander Dr. Rand Hazou on what New Zealand can do to stand against what is happening to Palestinians in Gaza.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
And we've got another piece coming up, but first, here's a quick song break. You're listening to The Wire on 95 BFM.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Wire on 95 BFM. Massey University has proposed cutting courses from the Albany Science Campus after the university reported a financial downturn. These cuts would affect more than 100 jobs and cause issues for students pursuing their masters and doctorates. I spoke to Professor of Ecology at Massey University, Dr. Diane Brunton, about the university's proposed cuts to the science campus. I started by asking what the cuts would mean for the science program.
Okay, well, what they've done is put out a change proposal for the College of Sciences. There's a bunch of change proposals happening in different colleges, but the one that affects the sciences in Albany and some of the sciences in Palmerston North is a big one, because it It proposes that all of the lab-based experimental sciences on the Albany campus will go. And all of the students, including masters and PhD students, if that went ahead, would have to either go to Palmerston North, go somewhere else, or drop out of their studies. So it's a huge impact. And some of the background to that is that in the proposal they have some financial analysis, which we are, we have questioned for a good reason. There's a lot of stuff in there that just doesn't make sense. And so the justification for it, we think, is wrong. And we think that they really need to take a look at, you know, have someone independent take a look at the finances, because things like the space charges that we have for, we've just moved into a new science building, basically. And some of the space charges in that building are just not even spaces that exist. They removed some of those now, I think, but that initial proposal has got all sorts of areas that don't belong to the College of Science, in fact, that they are kind of communal areas for all students at the university. So there's so much in this document that is, you know, just not correct. It misrepresents what the financial situation is like. And they really need to, if they're worried about the finances, we're proposing that they take a careful look at an independent financial expert in to take a look. That investment would be worth it.
And I just wanted to ask what you think the motives are behind targeting sciences and targeting the Albany campus.
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. Really, we're new up here. I guess that, you know, there's kind of this retrenchment back to Palmerston North. And Palmerston North is it's an older campus. It is where Massey started. And Albany's pretty new. Wellington's pretty new as well. It doesn't make any sense because, you know, we know what Auckland is like. It is growing and it's going to continue growing. And the Massey campus is a beautiful campus and it's sitting right in the heart of all this growth. So there's not really any justification for pulling sciences out. And we know how important sciences are for the future in all sorts of things. I mean, I'm a conservation biologist, so I know in my field, you know, how conservation is so important for maintaining our biodiversity. And there's so many things to do in that space that students really want to do too. But yeah, it just makes no sense. I think, you know, obviously all the universities in New Zealand are struggling with their finances, but we just have this move to find a quick solution, and cutting off all of the sciences in the Albany campuses seems to be what they've landed on.
Was there any consultation with staff about these cuts at all?
Well, we're under consultation now, and it was extended by a few days, but that consultation period, you know, what that takes to be able to really consult is good information. So we got the document about 3 weeks ago, and we questioned a lot of the information, and we've been working with the union, going back, asking for more information, for better information, for justification for some of their numbers, for the methodology that they used. And that coming back to us, that information has kind of trickled back. It's not all back yet, and I think that's why they extended the consultation a little bit longer. But, you know, we can't do something in 3 weeks that they have been working on for months. Right? We can't repeat their analysis unless we have all their data or understand their data. And we shouldn't be expected to. We can comment on it and we can point out the problems with it, but we shouldn't be expected to do their work for them in terms of the financial analysis. So it just has hit at a terrible time of year. You know, it's hit towards now we're in the exam period. So the students were stressed because in the proposal, it suggests that the students just have to, you know, that won't be able to complete their studies where they chose to or with the people that they chose to work with.
What areas do you think that the university could possibly consolidate funds in order to keep this campus alive and open? And what areas do you think that they're not looking at cutting that maybe they should?
Well, that's a tough question because I don't have all the facts in front of me, right? So that's where you really, before you decide what you're going to cut, you've got to think about, your income as well, and you know where the areas for growth might be, and also whether you can ride out a storm. Because you know we've got, you know, obviously we're in tight times at the moment, but you know 2 years ago the university made a record profit, so less short-term thinking, and then I think involving the staff in ideas. So there's been very little of that. It's been this kind of managerial approach where the managers keep it all secret and drop a bomb. And we're not really involved apart from this kind of consultation period where the decision feels like it's already made. So I think, you know, they need to take a good look at that. We have high costs in terms of space charges. So, you know, they've already been at some work in terms of selling pockets of land, selling some assets that we don't need or don't, you know, won't need in the future. But my, you know, my focus here, I know the most about the Auckland campus, right? And my focus here is that I think a solution is for us to consolidate all the sciences that we have into our brand new building, the Innovation Complex building, and use that as a flagship building, because it really is amazing. And it's considered to be by the architects, and it's won awards, already the, you know, the best science building in the country. So, you know, that's looking at our strengths and figuring out not just where to cut, because cutting alone does nothing. It just means more cuts are coming. But figuring out income and, you know, having a longer-term vision than just the end of each financial year.
Well, and I guess looking long-term, if these proposed cuts do go forward, what implications do you think they'll have for our tertiary education, especially sciences in New Zealand?
Well, certainly for the immediate Auckland area where we are, you know, there's just a loss of, continued loss of opportunities for students to do the science that they might want to do with researchers that are active in science. I mean, we're only a relatively small group, but there is a gap here in on the North Shore and looking north and Northland. There is a gap in terms of access to education. So, you know, we lose that gap. It takes a step backwards. And then, you know, the researchers that I know, a lot of the researchers, and especially, of course, the ones in my school, and they're doing the most, some of the most amazing stuff, and that's going to be gone. And you can't fill that gap easily. So it's the lack of opportunity for students in the future. It's lack of you know, these people that are really thinking about important problems for New Zealand and for the world, right? And that's just gone. So it just sets us back.
That was Diane Brunton, Professor of Ecology at Massey University, talking about job cuts at Massey University in Albany.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa i kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpere Thursday. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today, academic and Palestinian New Zealander Dr. Rand Hazu, lecturer of language and culture at Auckland University of Technology, Richard Pamatato, and Professor of Ecology at Massey University, Dr. Diane Brunton. Ni rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou i whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.